Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
After having seen the continued violation of Somali sovereignty by the Ethiopian government, the Somali government came to a conclusion that we have to take these decisions, and it was the only way to respond to that those continued violations of sovereignty of Somalia by Ethiopia against Somalia.
Somalia's information minister says the administration in Mogadishu is not to blame for the tension with Ethiopia.
The president has, as you said, declared a national emergency because of the escalating crisis and what he referred to as an existential threat to the lives and well-being of young people in our country.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio declares a national emergency over the threat of drug abuse on the lives of young people in the country.
So many things are expected from the new cabinet. Most of them were maybe technocrats, senior civil, servants who were not very known in politics. You know, they were just doing their work, on the sidelines.
And Senegal's new president names his cabinet. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Somalia's Information, Culture and Tourism Minister says the administration in Mogadishu is not to blame for the increased tension with Ethiopia's government in Addis Ababa. Daud Awais says the government took a decision to expel Ethiopia's ambassador to Somalia over what he says was the continued violation of the country's sovereignty. Somalia had recalled its top envoy to Ethiopia following a memorandum of understanding signed between Ethiopia and the breakaway region of Somaliland. The accord grants Ethiopia access to the Red Sea, but Somalia protested and condemned the agreement. The expulsion, analysts say, appears to increase the tension between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa. Information, Culture and Tourism Minister tells me that the expulsion of Ethiopia's top envoy is aimed at protecting and defending Somalia's sovereignty at all costs.
Yes, after having seen the continued violation of Somalia's sovereignty by the Ethiopian government, the Somali government came to a conclusion that we have to take these decisions, and it was the only way to respond to that those continued and violations of sovereignty of Somalia by Ethiopia against Somalia. So we made to a conclusion that we have to close the two consulate offices of Ethiopia based in Hargeisa and Garowe, and also ordered the ambassador to go home for consultation.
But Mr. Information Minister, wouldn't this escalate the already tense situation between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa?
I think Somalia has taken a position of tolerance for a long time, since January when Ethiopia signed an unlawful memorandum of understanding with Somaliland, the region in Somalia. And if Somalia was about to escalate this situation, our decisions will have been seen on that occasion. But the tolerance and looking for diplomatic channels made us to wait until today, when we found out that Ethiopia is still continuing with its violation against Somali sovereignty. And this has to be done because we have to defend and protect our sovereignty by any means.
You have been sister countries. You've worked with each other. You've had good relationship with each other. Why don't you resolve this amicably, diplomatically?
If I take you back, when the new Somali government was formed in 2022 with the current president, our president Hassan Sheikh Mahamud, he made it clear that Somalia was up to make sure that it has a good relations with the neighboring countries, and also it has to be peaceful within Somalia with all the factions or all the groups that exist in Somalia. But the problem is that Ethiopia is not on that page of having a good relations or a good amicable or friendly and resolution with Somalia. And we have been telling the international community that we are to make sure that we want to make peace. We are open for diplomatic channels, but all those landed in the deaf ears of the Ethiopian government, and they continued with their tactics of violations of Somalia's sovereignty. And then this was the decision, the only decision that Somalia felt it might help Somalia to sustain and protect its sovereignty.
You are part of the IGAD community, both countries. Wouldn't this undermine the very essence of IGAD, of good neighborliness and ensure prosperity and security and peaceful democracy within that corridor in Africa?
It's true that as a region that has such kind of regional body, we were supposed to live in harmony, to live in a cooperation, to work hand in hand. But if one of the members is trying to undermine all these good manners of living together, then there's no any other option rather than responding or reacting to anything that is affecting our sovereignty.
Now that you've taken such a decision against Ethiopia, how do you engage Hargeisa?
Hargeisa is part of Somalia. Whatever is between Mogadishu and Hargeisa can be resolved by the Somali themselves. When it comes to any other issue that is related to foreign diplomacy that is supposed to be handled by the federal government of Somalia in Mogadishu and Hargeisa, we have been talking to make sure that the grievances that they have expressed when they decided to form their regional administration that's under Somalia, we are ready still to continue talking to Somaliland to make sure that we resolve our internal problems. But when it comes to foreign intervention, then Somalia has to be united.
After this expulsion, what happens next? How do you move forward?
We move forward with the current situation until Ethiopia realizes that it has to behave with the neighboring countries. It has to follow the international norms. It has to follow the regional conventions that have been signed with all the regional countries. So I think that would be the only solution, that if Ethiopia comes back into its mind and understands that there is a necessity of living in harmony, then I think that will be a way or a breakthrough to end this impasse.
Daoud Awith is Somalia's Information, Culture and Tourism Minister. He spoke with me from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank says that Somalia appears to be displeased with Ethiopia's invitation for a meeting with officials from the breakaway Somaliland region of Puntland. The move, Matthew Bryden says, was meant to encourage cooperation between Ethiopia and Puntland. It comes after Puntland announced its withdrawal of recognition of the federal government in Mogadishu. For analysis of the growing tension between Somalia and Ethiopia, I reach Matthew Bryden.
The immediate cause seems to be that Ethiopia invited a delegation from Puntland, a federal member state of Somalia, to Ethiopia and announced an enhancement of cooperation between Ethiopia and Puntland just yesterday. And this follows on Puntland announcing that it is withdrawing its recognition of the federal government, it's withdrawing from political processes in Mogadishu, constitutional review process, and other consultations in protest against the federal government's management of these processes. So Mogadishu is angered by Ethiopia engaging with Puntland at a time when Mogadishu has a dispute with Puntland itself. At least that's the immediate cause. But there are probably additional dynamics at work behind the scenes.
According to Information Minister Awith, Hargeisa is part of Somalia, and that any problem within Somalia must be resolved by Somalia, and that Ethiopia is infringing on its right, and that is why it took this next step of expelling its ambassador. What do you make of this?
Well, I think what the minister is referring to is that Ethiopia announced an agreement with Somaliland on January 1st, which suggested that Ethiopia would recognize Somaliland as a sovereign state in exchange for naval basing rights and possibly some other protocols, and that Ethiopia has now engaged with Puntland at a time that Mogadishu is fighting with Puntland. So Mogadishu is blaming Ethiopia for interference in Somalia's internal affairs, and there's certainly, you know, some grounds for that argument. But I think there's another issue here, which is Mogadishu scapegoating Ethiopia for what are essentially internal Somali problems. Somalia and Somaliland have been in talks for 12 years. Those talks have been going nowhere. The last round fell apart immediately before Somaliland and Ethiopia reached an agreement. largely because Mogadishu refuses to acknowledge Somaliland's grievances or to engage them in any serious political discussion. So Somaliland, having been de facto an independent state for 30 years, has turned to Ethiopia for support. Now, the Puntland issue is really a result of a constitutional crisis in Mogadishu, and it's not only Puntland that's protesting. It's a whole range of Somali political figures, including Mogadishu-based politicians and two former presidents, former prime minister, have denounced the federal government's management of the constitutional process. So deflecting the blame to Ethiopia may be a comfortable position for Mogadishu, but it really doesn't address the problem, which is that Puntland is a federal member state of Somalia and needs to be part of the process and needs to be consulted.
But with this expulsion, doesn't that increase the tension sharply between Addis Ababa and Mogadishu?
It appears to increase the tension. It's certainly a diplomatic signal of Mogadishu's displeasure. Just as Addis Ababa's engagement with Puntland was a signal of Ethiopian unhappiness with Mogadishu's behavior. But this is all still, at one level, just posturing. The most important relationship between Somalia and Ethiopia is the presence of Ethiopian troops inside Somalia, thousands of troops, protecting major urban centers and the Somali federal government from the threat of al-Shabaab. So until Somalia demands the withdrawal of Ethiopian forces, I think we can relegate these sorts of diplomatic disputes to posturing. Really, things will only get serious if Somalia demands the withdrawal of Ethiopian military forces.
So do you anticipate this tension or icy relationship that is developing so far to thaw anytime soon?
Well, it's clear that both sides still perceive al-Shabaab as a common enemy, even if their rhetoric suggests otherwise. And it is in their best interest to cooperate. A new proposal is being put forward for an African Union mission to begin in 2025. Ethiopia is part of the current mission and presumably would be part of the next one. So I think there are good grounds to believe that Mogadishu and Addis are going to resolve their differences. But that will not solve the core problems that the government in Mogadishu is facing, which is that Somaliland seeks full independence from Somalia and may eventually get it, and that Puntland has withdrawn from the constitutional process, the review process, which is Puntland's constitutional right. And Mogadishu needs to address these issues directly rather than deflecting the blame to Ethiopia.
Matthew Bryden is the co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Uganda, a journalist and businessman has filed a petition at the Supreme Court seeking to challenge the anti-homosexuality law. This after Andrew Mwenda also expressed disappointment with a judgment by the Constitutional Court, which refused to nullify the law or prevent the enforcement of the measure. In its judgment, the Constitutional Court also struck down some aspects of the law, including access to public health by LGBTQI+ persons. The enactment of the anti-homosexuality law attracted condemnation from some of Uganda's donors and international partners. However, Andrew Mwenda tells me that donors should stay out of the fight for anti-gay rights in Uganda.
I believe that homosexuals are normal human beings with a different sexual orientation and therefore should not be discriminated against in law. So I went to court to seek the annulment of the law because it infringes on basic rights of a human being, first to personal dignity, second to ownership of their bodies, and third to privacy. Because this law itself is so outrageous that among the provisions it was saying that if you are a parent, a doctor, a psychotherapist, a priest, a friend, a guardian of somebody who comes and tells you that they are gay, you are required to report this person to police. If you don't, you go to jail for 7 years.
As a leading member of those challenging the law and opposed to the law, what's next for you?
Yesterday, I filed a notice of intention to appeal in the Supreme Court. So, today, I submitted my appeal. We are appealing the Supreme Court against this decision.
What do you think?
The Supreme Court of Uganda does not accept, we shall go to the East African Court of Appeal. If the East African Court of Appeal does not do that, we shall go to the African Union Court of Human Rights. But we will go to any length to oppose this law. Any length.
What are the prospects of this challenge that you have launched at the Supreme Court of Uganda?
I am hoping that the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, will be able to see through the serious problems with the judgment of the court of the Constitutional Court. I am hoping so. But yesterday, Peter, when I sat in that court and listened to the Constitutional Court judgment, I was really, really disappointed. Because what the judges did, instead of referring to our Constitution to adjudicate this matter, they reverted to their prejudices, our cultural bigotry, their traditional beliefs, to make a judgment. So very little they try to interpret the Ugandan Constitution based on our traditional prejudices and cultural bigotry. It was so disappointing. I thought that the courts in Uganda would stand above traditional prejudices and cultural bigotry and defend humanity. I was so disappointed that they failed so miserably to rise up to the occasion. I am appealing to the Supreme Court of Uganda, please, if you are listening to this program, please, this is your moment to make history. People may denounce you today. In the next 30, 40 years, you will be seen as the most visionary court in the whole world. People will not believe that you could go against deeply entrenched cultural bigotry and stand above it and defend human rights.
Really, I understand you are calling on international partners and the donor community to stay away from this fight in Uganda. Talk to me about
yes.
that.
The homophobes in Uganda, those people who are homophobic, who support this law, they argue that this law is engineered by the Western powers who want to impose their values of homosexuality on the people of Uganda. That homosexuality is not indigenous to Uganda. It is an export of the Western countries, and these Western countries want to impose it on Ugandans. So when Western countries come with a lot of pressure to say, we are going to sanction you, we are going to impose visa restrictions on you, we are going to ban you from traveling, what they are simply saying, what they are doing is affirming the rumors, the suspicions, the beliefs in Ugandans that this is an external imposition on Uganda. And I'm saying no. We don't need foreign help. We Ugandans can argue this case ourselves. And we can win on the merits that this is a local agency. There is no external interference in this matter. There is external interference because evangelical conservatives in America are funding all this process. We know. But they are doing it undercover. So since they are not known to be involved on the other side, for us of this side, we think we can win without international help. Dear friends and allies, we appreciate your solidarity, but please, we don't need your help. Your help is counterproductive to our efforts.
Andrew Mwenda is a journalist and businessman. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio has declared a national emergency over what he says is the existential threat of drug abuse on the lives of young people in the country. In an address to the nation, the president expressed concern about the impact of drugs and drug addiction on young people. This, as health officials say, unemployed youth are abusing Kush, a synthetic drug in parts of the country, including the capital, Freetown. Information and Civic Education Minister Chen Uba says the president has established a task force to deal with the problem. He also tells me that the government is working with its neighbors, including Guinea and Liberia, both of whom are having similar challenges, to jointly address the problem.
The president has, as you said, declared a national emergency because of the escalating crisis and what he referred to as an existential threat to the lives and well-being of young people in our country. If you look at the data, we've seen that, for example, there's been over 1,231% increase from 222 cases in 2020 to over 2,955 cases in 2023 alone. Particularly alarming is that the Kush use increased by, in terms of numbers, a staggering 3,800% in terms of cases that we register in our hospitals. And keep in mind that's a gross underestimation. So what His Excellency was saying was enough is enough. Anybody that was involved, that he actually declared yesterday, that's involved in the importation, wholesale distribution of any drug, the time was up. He wanted to draw the attention of the state as he's done in the past. And he said we'll focus on five main areas. And one of those is on prevention. And he wants this to be a humane approach. So for the users, we're going to focus on rehabilitation, social welfare, and social care. But for those who distribute, for those who bring this into our country, we're going to bring the full force of the laws of our country on them. And as you said, there will be no sacred cows.
You talked about there will be no sacred cows, but the issue a lot of people are raising is some people are bringing these drugs into the country, and perhaps they might have been heavily connected. Those are the allegations that perhaps there are ways they are finding to bring these kinds of drugs into the country.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, the Ministry of Health has conducted some laboratory studies on the content of this really toxic drug that's called Kush. So apparently it's a mix between drugs that are imported legally into the country, so for different reasons, cocaine and other kinds of drugs, and then mixed with other local products and products in the country. So what we need to do, as you said, is to disrupt the supply flow, to understand all of the drugs coming into the country that are meant for legitimate use, to be able to understand how they are making it into this illegal drug trade and track that. I think, again, the declaration by the president acknowledges that this is a major issue and that, yes, we up until now have not been able to adequately deal with it and in all its ramifications. But I think people of Australia know that when the Excellency declares something of this nature, he's always been able to mobilize the state, the resources, and the attention of our country to do the right thing. And clearly, this is what's going to happen in this case.
The drug, which is also known as K2, is easily accessible to mostly unemployed young people seeking an escape from poverty. The question people are asking is, will the government implement some measures to try to employ some of these youth in order to prevent them from engaging in some of these dangerous acts that the president talked about?
Absolutely. And as I said, the president mentioned five major areas: prevention, care and treatment, social services support, law enforcement, and community engagement. The social services support is a key area because you're right. It's the idea that people are seeking alternatives. You know, we held a national town hall just a few days before the president made that declaration. We brought users, young people, activists, and government ministers, and one of the folks who came forward to share their stories. It included some heart-rending stories, and most of them is the lack of livelihoods alternatives. But in the president's speech yesterday, he mentioned his investment in human capital in the country, which is really something that he's done, and his focus on Feed Salon, which is to really mobilize our young people's energy to, you know, harness that into the agricultural sector, and his promise to deliver 500,000 jobs in the next 5 years. So he's focused as well on tangible alternatives in the long term, but in the short term, as well as part of this response to this Kush crisis, we're going to look at areas for these sorts of social support, finding alternatives to our young people so they can get engaged, and making sure that they don't think that, you know, seeking the temporal and dangerous high of drugs is the best route, I should say.
Guinea, your neighboring countries, including Guinea and Liberia, I understand are also fighting to contain an increase in coos consumption. Will there be an engagement with your sister countries to address this problem?
Well, I think people are aware that we're not a first country to have made this declaration. I think our counterparts in Liberia have also been talking about it. Guinea has also been, you know, engaged in some activities on this to try to respond to this. And we have a very close security and other collaboration with our sister countries. We intend to continue to engage them. We've already been involved in some operations with, for example, Guinea, to be able to track flows and see where these tribal people are using the porousness of our borders to bring dangerous items into our country. So we will definitely work together. This is a problem that cannot be solved by one country, and I think we'll take advantage of the good relationship we have within our sub-region to tackle this together. It's the only way it can be done.
Chan Oba is Sierra Leone's Information and Civic Education Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency, or CSA, says an audit has uncovered more than 40,000 illegal civil servants. Josiah Jokai says the move forms part of the government's determination to ensure transparency and to combat corruption. The administration, he adds, spends about $23 million monthly to pay civil servants. Jokai launched a payroll cleanup campaign after the government expressed concern about what some officials say appears to be a bloated payroll system. Josiah Jokai tells me that some of the illegal servants did not receive a mandatory personal action notice, which he says is a major requirement for employment.
So we asked our employment services department to query the entire payroll data, and they did exactly that with the goal of identifying bona fide civil servants on the payroll. This is part of a national payroll cleanup campaign process that I launched as soon as I took over as Director General of the Civil Service Agency of Liberia. The overarching goal is to streamline the workforce, make it efficient, and make it very productive. And we want to match that measure with the wage bill. We have a huge wage bill, $23 million United States dollars monthly just to pay civil servants. That's a huge chunk of the national budget. And we also have a total workforce strength of the public service to be 67,746. We think that that's very, very huge. And so the goal has been to audit the payroll and make sure that it is free of ghost names, removing inefficiencies, irregularities, in the public service. So we queried that data, the payroll data, and we realized that there are two categories of illegal civil servants on the payroll. The first category is the group of civil servants who initiated what we call the PAN process. The PAN is the Personnel Action Notice. By law, everyone who becomes a civil servant must go through the PAN process. You should complete the PAN. It's a form that tells us your background in terms of your qualifications, your skills, your knowledge, your experience, your cultural fit in terms of your core values, which you align with the institution you are applying to work for. So it tells us that the first group of people, about 19,600, did not go through that process. They did not initiate that process. And then you have another group of civil servants who did not initiate the PAN process at all.
For the 40,000 illegal civil servants in your system, what is going to happen to them?
So we have issued a circular to the 103 spending entities, encouraging them to have those individuals affected by the situation to come to the civil service agency and complete their PAN process. We have given them a 90-day period. We hope that that's fair enough. Within 3 months, they should be able to complete the PAN process. so that they can regularize their status as employees of the civil service.
Talking about regularizing their services as employees, shouldn't there be a record or a paper trail about the processes that led to the employment of these civil servants?
The administration of President George Manning Weah, the civil service agency employed those people just through mail, text messages, phone calls that came from heads of other government entities, telling them to place the names of individuals on the payroll. And then later on, they could complete the paying process. But here's the thing, Peter. When I took over, I met a huge pile of incomplete pens, thousands of incomplete pens, pens that some of those individuals initiated, but was never signed by the former director general, my predecessor. So those pens, I quarantined them, and I have them stacked up. And so those pens should form part of the pens of those who initiated the process, which the category that's part of the 40,000, but they're not completed. And so you can imagine there are so many of them in that category. So it means that those people were employed through illegal means.
Talking about legal framework, will there be a measure to ensure a smooth process to prevent such occurrences in the future?
That is correct. And that's part of our reform process. So we are doing a complete reform of the civil service that is required. And in the immediate term, we are cleaning the payroll. We are making sure that people on the payroll and the employee listings of the 103 government entities concerned, we make sure that they are people who meet the qualification. We establish a pay grade to ensure a merit-based civil service, so that we professionalize it. And as I said, we have to bring integrity to the public service. We have to bring integrity to the payroll so that we can improve the efficiency and the productivity of the government.
Josiah Jokai is the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Senegal's President Bassirou Diomaye Faye named a cabinet of 25 ministers on Friday, appointing a host of fresh faces to top roles following his landslide election victory last month. The 44-year-old, who has never before held elected office, won a first-round victory on a promise of radical reform, becoming the country's youngest president. Faye, who is set to share responsibilities with his appointed prime minister and former mentor Ousmane Sonko, who helped propel the political newcomer's rise to power, hailed his new cabinet as a break from the past. To find out more about Senegal's new cabinet, viewers Douglas Mpuga reached reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar.
The new cabinet, the members of cabinet that have been appointed yesterday are people of great integrity. For example, the Minister of Industry and Commerce, Mr. Diop, who built a school in his community with his meager resources. And that school is now transformed into a full-fledged high school. And you also have other members of the government like General Burama Diop, a former military advisor to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, is the new Minister of Defense. He's also well known in Senegal for his extraordinary contribution to society.
Mr. Faye has never held elected office before. Does his cabinet reflect that fact? And how do people gauge it there?
Yes, it is very effective because, you know, the new cabinet is headed by his political mentor, Ousmane Sonko, who is the prime minister. And yesterday, when the new cabinet was announced, Mr. Sonko said that the delay was just because they wanted to screen and see the people whose hands are clean and the people who can give, you know, services to the country without expecting anything from the country. That's why it takes time to form the government. Anyway, people there have been reaction. They said that, I mean, this is a very good cabinet because they have cut the number of ministries to 25, and they also included, you know, Secretary of State. So if you compare his cabinet to the previous cabinet, you know, so they have, you know, reduced the number of ministries. So people are saying that maybe the cabinet is going to meet the aspirations of the people.
Mr. Faye and his Prime Minister, Mr. Sonko, are fairly young, according to African politics. How young is the cabinet? Is it the same age range?
Yes, apart from the Minister of Defense and the Minister of Commerce and Industry, some of the cabinet members are very young. And even the Mr. Faye's, you know, I mean, Cabinet Secretary, Marito Nyan, who served also before in as a minister under President Macky Sall as Minister of Higher Education. They are all, you know, they are all, I mean, very young people. They are not very old. Apart from Marito Nyan, he's the other ones I know, those whose faces were shown on TV yesterday, they are all between 40, 45, or 50. I think none of them is above 50 years. So they all look young. They all look energetic.
Is anybody in the cabinet who is from another party?
No. You see, this is, I mean, exactly what, I mean, they've been saying that the reason what delayed the cabinet, because people thought that maybe they would offer, I mean, cabinet post to those, I mean, who supported them, like their allies, like, you know, Mrs. Aminata Touré, who once served as Prime Minister under Macky Sall. People thought that they are going to offer her a cabinet post. I didn't see any of those, I mean, members of cabinet who served once in any of, I mean, President Macky Sall's cabinet or former President Ablai Wade's cabinet. These are all new people. In fact, it was very difficult for me to get, I mean, to try to profile them because they are, most of them are where, you know, they are maybe technocrats, senior civil, you know, servants who were not very known in politics. You know, they were just doing their work, I mean, on the sidelines.
Given the situation in Senegal now, what are the people's expectations of this new cabinet?
Yes, so many things are expected from the new cabinet. Mr. Bassirou Faye, during his nation address, said that there are so many urgent things to be looked into, some priorities. Most of them will be youth employment, you know, also the sky rocketing prices of, you know, essential commodities. In fact, Mr. Faye said that immediately the cabinet is formed, the ministers are known, he will summon the Chamber of Commerce and some of the top business people into a meeting so that they'll see how best they can reduce, I mean, some of the essential commodities like, you know, rice, oil, and other, you know, condiments. The prices are getting high. In fact, you can just compare what is happening in Senegal to what we call galloping inflation. You just go and buy something. The next day, you go to the shop again. You'll find the prices of such a product, I mean, rising again.
Alpha Jallo is a reporter in Senegal. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from the capital, Dakar. In Togo, a democratic governance expert says a move by President Faure Gnassingbé to carry out a referendum to allow citizens to have a say on the recent constitutional reform will help ease tensions. Attorney Paul Amegakpo is the president of the Tembema Institute for Governance. He says members of parliament who voted on the measure to amend the constitution did not have the legal authority to do so because their term had expired last year. This, he says, occurred after regional and parliamentary elections were postponed last year. His remarks come after the presidency announced the postponement of the coming April 20 parliamentary and regional elections. Civil society and religious groups are calling on the president not to sign a new parliamentary measure into law. The controversial legislation amends the constitution to allow parliament to choose the next president. For the latest development, I reach Paul Amegakpo in the Togolese capital, Lomé.
We are in a situation where the political contest is very tense, and there is no consensus, no dialogue around the constitution change process engaged by the government. So what we can say now is that Togolese don't understand where the government would like to lead them to, because we need to have a clear timeline on the electoral process, and this timeline is unknown now, and the process ongoing in parliament is not accepted by a wide range of populations. So we can say that we are in a weird situation, and we don't know how the future can be.
Some Togolese are telling me that opposition groups and civil society groups who are opposed to the recent amendment have themselves to blame, because the opposition is poorly represented in the parliament, which allowed for the governing party to pass this law with pretty much no resistance and to block this move that they dislike. What are your thoughts?
Yes, because opposition parties boycotted the parliamentary elections in 2018, and this allowed the majority of the ruling party to have the majority of members of parliament. It's why they have the fourth on five to change the constitutional law. We think that the responsibility belongs to both sides, the majority in power and the opposition. But this year, political parties for every side decided to participate to the upcoming elections, parliamentary and regional election. We think that it's time to give chance to this process to be peaceful so that we can have a real representative and legitimacy around the elected official in the parliament and in the regional councils. But the change of the constitution process, which is ongoing, can undermine this hope that Togolese have now.
But Paul, what do you think can bring the tension down?
The current parliament is illegitimate and illegal to study and vote the change of the constitution. So what we think will be better to calm down the tension is to remove simply this process of review of our fundamental law. If the government and the parliament decide to remove this process, this law, I think that the situation will become normal, and this contest can allow a fair and peaceful electoral process. Otherwise, if they continue to study and vote this law without a referendum, and there we are thinking that maybe they postpone the parliamentary and regional election to vote the law and allow the president to call for referendum, because the president can call for referendum. People are asking two things. First, remove the constitutional review process, or to call for a referendum to allow people to vote directly for or against this law. So maybe he would like to organize the parliamentary, regional, and referendum at the same time to allow citizens to vote for this new constitutional provision by referendum. But I think that this second scenario is not the scenario expected by a large majority of Togolese.
Paul Amegakpo is the president of the Tambema Institute for Governance. He spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
bongo so aron mukoka.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer Miss Tiang Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a borrowed fiddle does not finish a tune. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Emmanuel Adibayor, Madame Mona Room, Chancel Mbemba, Azmat.